I don't even know what this case means.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. So I said,
yes.
Still this potential.
No, no, that's, look, I'm sure that there are some mathematical niceties that I may miss. But by the way, in most cases that I've encountered in physics till I started to look at this thing, all the mathematical niceties were just useless. You know, epsilon and delta, and change this limit with that limit. And here it's exactly a place where everything comes into play. Non-analyticity, infinite sums, whatever. And all these things are important. Of course, I went through a route that tried to avoid them. And I used the shift operator, as you can do with the Fourier transform. But once you have to write your sums, you have to be careful. So it's not always that physicists could ignore all the mathematical niceties. Some of them really have deep physical meaning. All right, other questions? Yes, please.
Speaking of mathematical niceties, when will we, when shall we discuss the problems?
Well, how about more than 15 minutes after?
Well, I think the answers to the problems are relevant to what you're talking about.
All right, so you want me to solve them?
No.
That's the option.
No, I'm just asking when we'll talk about them, because I think it's sort of immediately of immediate interest.
Okay, we can. Look, let me continue now. And let's see where we get. And then we'll take a decision from it. Okay? Yes, other questions? No.
Oh, yes. I was trying to think of a simple answer to this. I don't know. Is there an experimental or operational meaning to that shift operator?
That's a good thing. This is a non-local operator. Because it shifts things from one place to another. As long as you stick in the framework of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that's what we do, there is no problem in principle why this should not be measurable. On the other hand, reality is not non-relativistic quantum mechanics, because we have limitations of speed of light and other things. So then one has to be a bit more careful exactly how you can measure such an operator. The point being that if I start with a wave packet here and I measure the operator, no matter what IN value I receive, this thing may be spread all over the place. And then the requirement that we should not go faster than speed of light will come into place. So it cannot be measured easily. Now, there are some methods that allow you to measure it instantaneously, but they are more complex. You need entangled measuring devices, things that can create and annihilate particles, so it's a bit more complicated. Also, the only thing that you actually need, you need to know the value of this operator. You don't need to be able to prepare an eigenstate. You see, an ordinary formal measurement does two things for you. It tells you about what was the state before, or whatever, gives you some information, but it also prepares a state after. These are two independent things that a formal measurement does. As long as you are just interested in getting results, you may have destructive measurements there. So there are ways of measuring. But they are not simple, but it's a very good exercise to try to think how you would measure this observation. But of course, once again, it can take a long time to look about it. But no matter what the thing is, this is the only place where information about interference is contained. So you should not look at any other observers. Oh, by the way, just before starting, somebody asked me a question which is relevant, and I wasn't sure. So these two wave packets are, of course, at a distance. So the question was, how do they interfere? Well, they will interfere in time. So if I let them spread, then they will come and overlap and that phase alpha comes into play. All right. So let me just show you some other things. You start with these two slits. You let, by the way, this is the wave function immediately after it comes through the two slits. Yes, but I looked at the one-dimensional version for this implement. So this is x there. And you have some uncertainty relation, delta x, delta t. Now suppose that somebody comes and tries to find out which slit the thing went through. And when it does that, all your beautiful interference pattern here gets destroyed. So what happens with the uncertainty? So this is the uncertainty in the initial function, and this is the uncertainty in the final function, that is the one disturbed by the measurement. Okay? So people ask many times, how comes that a measurement destroys my interference pattern? It must be that the uncertainty is much larger than the uncertainty in the non-disturbed thing. Well, just do the computation. And you'll find that this is total rubbish. The uncertainty, in fact, goes down. If you find out which way, which slit the thing went through, the new uncertainty is much, much smaller than the original uncertainty. Okay? Now, how comes that measuring x, because originally I didn't know where is x, here or there, by now, this is a big distance, L, and this is a small slit. So initially I had a large uncertainty about x, now I have a much smaller one. How comes that the uncertainty about p didn't increase? Well, why should it? You know, not all the time when you localize better the function in x, the uncertainty in p must increase. That is only if you are very close to the limit. Delta x, delta p, almost like h bar. But if it is very large, there is enough place to play with. So this, in fact, becomes much, much smaller than that. So that how can I understand the loss of interference from the point of view of Heisenberg uncertainty relation? Okay, any answer? How can I understand the loss of interference from the point of view of Heisenberg uncertainty? What? Yes?
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer your question, but I mean, I do know that if you're making a measurement, I mean, you're, however you want to interpret it, you're collapsing.
That was not a question. How can I understand it from Heisenberg uncertainty? From this.
Well, I mean,
you know a certain lambda, you know, like kind of the wavelength beforehand, so by that you might know the momentum, you know.
But what was I talking about? What is delta x? X squared average minus x average squared, that is this, times p squared average minus p average squared. Yeah, this is delta x, delta p. Now, do you recognize these beautiful things? Do they tell you something about entanglement, about interference? Ah, no. That's the answer. Heisenberg uncertainties tell you nothing about interference, because none of the things that come into it depends on it. Okay? That's why these behave in a funny way. Why do they do it? What do I have? They have nothing to do with interference. Okay? Many times people ask, how comes that I make a measurement and now something changes? Well, interesting things happen. But those interesting things do not happen at this level. They happen at the level of the non-local equations. Okay? Yes, please.
But
But here, the infinite sum and the square root doesn't matter?
Oh, no. I just take the square root of this. No, because you really look at these numbers. And they have no problems. All right. So I should look at interesting things. And the next thing that I would like to look is the loss of interference. But let me do it in a different way. So let me take this example again. A wave function that is here and here. And let me say that this is a charged particle. No spin, so forget it. It's an electron without spin. Pi of whatever. Right. So the wave function, psi of x, 1 over root 2, psi 1 of x plus psi 2 of x. And now let's suppose that I take here a capacitor. And I charge this capacitor. What happens when I charge the capacitor? I make, okay, do you remember? So here is a capacitor. Here I put plus. Here I put minus. There is a force here. The potential looks like that. There is no force. The force is zero outside. And there is just a force between them. So this is the potential. Yes? It is V1, V2 outside. And the change of potential is only inside the capacitor. OK? Right. So the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus v of x and t. It's a function of t because I open the capacitor and I close it. OK? When I open it, so when I charge, well, I open it like this. So it may stay open, and I charge it, and I discharge it. So the potential originally was the same, then it develops a difference, then I bring it back. The electron feels no force. Yeah? Because there is no electric field outside the plane capacitor. Let me, for the time being, assume that a particle is very heavy, a really heavy electron, without spin. So there is no kinetic energy. I can forget about the kinetic energy. The only thing that is important here is the potential. So then the wave functions are just eigenfunctions of the potential. OK? That's all it happens. Or you may think that you look on time scales that are small enough versus the time that the wave packet spreads. So let's do everything. So then what is the evolution of the wave function when I put this potential? Well, so suppose I have my Hamiltonian is just V of x, but psi 1 is in the region where the potential is just a number, V1. Doesn't depend on x in the region of psi 1. So the time evolution, psi 1 of x and t will be simply e to the minus I integral v1 dt over h bar of psi 1. So it's simply e to the minus I v1 t d tau from 0 to time t. So it's v1 t over h bar psi 1. It's a constant potential, so the Hamiltonian is just a constant. It adds up a phase. Yeah, this is e to the I minus I integral h dt over h. What happens with psi 2? Psi 2 of x and t is just e to the minus I b to t over h bar psi 2 of x and time 0. So if I do this lovely thing, opening a capacitor and closing it, then psi of x and t becomes 1 over root 2 e minus I v1t over h bar psi 1 of x plus e minus I v2t over h bar psi 2 of x. Or if I want to say it like this, it's 1 over root 2 e minus I v1t over h bar. Let me take this phase outside. Psi 1 of x plus e minus I v2 minus v1t over h bar psi 2. So what happens is that by charging the capacitor, I just modify the relative phase between psi 1 and psi 2. So I modify the phase alpha in the thing. Right? So now if I charge it and discharge it, and then I let the two-wave packets come and interfere, the interference pattern will be changed. Because originally the phase was zero, now the phase is alpha given by this whole thing. Okay? So what happened with my electron while I put this? What changed for the electron? Well, only the observable that depends on the relative phase. Not the average of x, not the average of p, the average of e to the I pl over h bar. And that changed. Now, of course, this is just a particular instance of this equation. When I took v of x plus l, so in one region to be v1, in the other region to be v2. So that means, let me go back to my wave function here. Something very interesting happens here. I have an electron that sits here and there. Doesn't touch the capacitor, doesn't enter in the capacitor. There are no forces acting on it. Since there are no forces acting on it, you know by, yes, please.
Is it important to charge and discharge the capacitor slowly so that the evolution of the potential
no.
is taken back?
No. No. Not at all. Outside a capacitor, there is no field. It's a plane. Of course, if it is not infinite plane but small, you want to make sure that there is no radiation, so you do it.
Right, but
slow.
We know the potential change.
Yeah, but the potential just changes, it's just constant. Outside. It just goes up and down.
Okay.
Right. So there are no forces on this stuff. Since there are no forces, the average momentum couldn't change. And that we already know, the average momentum is independent on the relative phase. Right? But something in the momentum does change. The distribution of momentum changes. Because by now, this guy, e to the I pl over h bar, well, remember this was equal to half of the phase. So this is e to the I v2 minus v1 t over h bar, the average of this. Yeah, it was equal to half e to the I alpha. So the distribution of the momentum changes without any force acting on them, but changes in a strange way. Changes in such a way that none of the moments of the distribution of momentum is changed, only the modular variables. I call them modular because all that happens here depends not on P or on PL over H bar, but depends on PL over H bar, on P, let L over H bar modulo 2 pi. Yes, it doesn't matter whether it has 2 pi. Right. By the way, this is called the scalar Aharonov moment. When you apply a potential difference between two-wave packets without putting forces. But what we found is that the way in which the momentum distribution changes is in such a way that none of the moments change, but only the modular part. Yeah?
So are the convolution scales similar to the Aharonov?
Well, this is the Aharonov moment.
Yeah, so why, let's simply then deal with the vector potential. Why do you have to come up?
Did you ever read the paper?
I did.
Well, this is in there.
Is it? No, you didn't read the original paper.
Ah. But in the original. Yes. The original paper contains two things, the scalar and the magnetic. Okay. Of course, the original paper doesn't tell all this story that I was telling. Then just tells about the fact that there is a phase and that the phase is observable. So this story doesn't appear there. But by the way, just to make things clear, this is not my stuff. This is Aharonov's stuff. Okay? And there are a couple of papers published in the 60s about this, probably two or three papers. And I urge you to go and do. And by the way, there is a new book that appeared about half a year ago. Aharonov and Roglic. And Roglic. That contains a lot of this material. Okay, I think it's quantum paradoxes or something like that. Which is, in my view, probably the most important book on quantum mechanics since the founding fathers. Yes.
So, okay. So, for the magnetic moment, that's experimental test.
Yeah. For both of them.
For this is experiment has been conducted for this.
I don't know.
Oh,
I don't. All right, now, the momentum of the electron changes. What about the momentum of the capacitor? Momentum is conserved. So here I wrote like a potential V of x, but I should have written it V of x1 minus x2 if I want to quantize the location of the capacitor. Okay. So now suppose that I'm dealing with a two-body problem. This has its center of mass that is located there. So the two-body problem is psi 1 x1 plus psi 2 of x2 times phi of x1 plus phi of x, let me put x electron of x capacitor. Okay? And the Hamiltonian is what I should have written is v of x electron minus x of capacitor. And it's this thing, yes? So the field. In the observable x electron minus x capacitor. This one since it's a Hamiltonian, which is a function of the relative axis, conserves the total, P total, which is P electron plus P capacitor. This is conserved. How do I know it is conserved? Well, I know it's conserved because it commutes with the Hamiltonian. P electron minus P capacitor d over dt is IH, I over h bar, P electron minus P capacitor commutator with V plus P capacitor, V of x electron minus x capacitor, and this is zero. Right. So since the momentum of the electron changes, the capacitor must get the feedback. But the electron doesn't come to the capacitor. Now, look at that physical situation. You ask yourself, how do I measure e to the I pl over h bar? How do I measure that modular thing? And my answer was that you cannot measure it instantaneously. It is a function, there are two wave packets that are separated in space, and it will take a long time for you to be able to measure. Now, that is not to say that I cannot make the interaction with the measuring device instantaneous, but maybe the measuring device consists of two pieces that are entangled and it will take some long time to read. In any case, relativity forbids me to find out the change of the modular value of the momentum of the electron in a short time. However, the capacitor just sits here. It's quite well localized in the center. So since they are conserved, then any function of of the total momentum must be conserved. So then I would like to look at e to the I p capacitor times L over h bar. And if the modular thing of the electron changes, this one should change as well. But now, because this is localized here, I should immediately see the change. But suppose the electron wasn't there to stack it. Then the capacitor shouldn't feel any change at all. So it means that something is problematic with causality. Because I'm able, looking at a capacitor, to see whether an electron was out there or not. Something doesn't feel right. So let's get a better grip on mathematics of this one. By the way, how long do I have? So I have 21 minutes. All right, good. Right, so what should I do? I should look at this object, e to the I p electron plus p capacitor L over h bar, and look at the average of this stuff. Okay? Now, the average of this guy is simply e to the I p electron L over h bar average times e to the I p capacitor L over h average. Why is that? Because the evolution of this wave function is simply psi 1 of x plus e to the I v1 minus v2 p over h bar psi 2 of x electron times phi of x capacitor e to the I v1 p over h bar. So the electron and the capacitor never get entangled. They start in a direct product state, and they remain in a direct product state. As long as I'm talking about wave functions that are not entangled, this average is the product of the two averages. If you don't believe, you can take it as a homework. Okay? And this must be constant. Right. But this guy changes. This guy equals e to the I, it's half e to the I v1 minus v2 t over h bar. So this guy changes in time. If this guy would change in time as well, I could see it. Because this, remember, the wave function of the capacitor is localized. And I can do every measurement instantaneously. So this must be, this must be constant. But how can it be? So this times a constant must give some other constant. How can this be? Sorry?
The first one's constant.
If this one is what?
No. So how can that be? Well, the first one's constant.
No, but this is not. This is explicitly e to the I v1 minus v2. Ah, that's it. So this constant must be zero. So it must be that the average of the modular momentum of the capacitor must be zero. If it is not zero, I run into problems with causality. Okay? Well, in fact, this is a beautiful thing. Not only, okay, let me look more carefully at the modular momentum. So the object I had in mind is e to the I p capacitor L over h bar. This is the same thing as p capacitor L over h bar modulo 2 pi. This is the basic element that enters into that phase. That phase is like an angle, yes? That's what it is. So it is an observable, this one, that looks very much like an N. Okay. E here over H1. Or this. It's just a phase. Okay. For such an observable that is with constant support, like an angle, I can discuss about absolute uncertainty. The absolute uncertainty is when this object is equally distributed everywhere. So the values of this guy should be uniformly distributed over 2 pi when the capacitor is in that wave function. If these values are distributed evenly over 2 pi, it means that this guy, the average of this guy is zero in particular. So then I got my equation here. Okay. Now,
can you just review real quick, what is the argument that says that you can't measure? I mean, I realize that if you can measure these, that variable,
Then
you can measure the other one. Why can't you measure the other one quickly?
Well, then I find about the existence of an electron far apart.
You find out which slit it went through? Or
no. I find that there was an electron to start with. If there wouldn't be one, it doesn't matter that I open the capacitor or close.
Oh.
All right. So my point is that in order for this to be zero, and in fact I can look not only to this average, but I can take many other powers of this, because I could look to some other power, e to the I n times PE plus PC over h bar times L. So in fact, you can make an argument that e to the I times every number n PCL over h bar average must be zero. So in order not to run into problems with causality, this must be the case. Right.
I think I might just be getting stuck in the math here, but
yeah.
It seems like another alternative is if the electron changed in multiples of 2 pi over h
bar. Oh, no, but the change is continuous. This is the change. This change I proved it, so.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Sorry.
So the upshot is that, in fact, not only this, but all, if I multiply by n, all these things, all these averages must be zero. That is indeed true if and only if p l h bar modulo 2 pi is completely uncertain. Okay? So this is your homework. If this is true for all n, then this is true, and vice versa. Okay. Yes, please.
Can you define what the p c l over h bar minus 2 pi is?
Do you know what 7 modulo 2 is?
Isn't this an operator?
Yeah, so any function, this means that if I apply p c l over h bar mod 2 pi, let me put here the sign of operator, to any eigenfunction p of momentum, okay, let's have an eigenfunction p0, which is momentum operator p to p0 gives the number p0, p0. Well, this should give, let's not put p capacitor there, will give p0l h bar mod 2 pi applied to the vector p0. Any function of an operator can be defined by looking at how it works on the eigenstates of that operator. Oh, so by this I said that it must be the case that for any function of the capacitor here, all these things should give zero. But how can it be that for any functions it could be that? Well, actually, it's not for any functions. For any functions that are such that the capacitor is between these two effects. Okay? It must be between these two effects, because if it is there, then it affects these two with the same potential and not with a difference of potential. But that is quite simple to see, because let me look at the average of this thing. Phi of x capacitor star e to the I n p capacitor L over h bar phi of x capacitor dx. This is a shift operator for that thing for the distance nL. And I just said that I want phi to be localized between the two wave packets. So if it is that, the moment I shift it with a distance larger than L, there is no overlap, so this must be zero. Well, it's probably a bit too much mathematics by now, so I will stop soon. So the upshot is that there is a wonderful interplay. The observables that encode interference for the electron itself, they are non-local observables. They obey non-local equations of motion. Since they obey non-local equations of motion, they can be affected from a distance. In this case, I affected them by a capacitor that sits nowhere near the electron. But the capacitor itself shouldn't be able to see it. and it is not able to see. Although things happen to the capacitor, the momentum of the capacitor changes, but the distribution, that is, the modular momentum changes, but the distribution of the modular momentum was flat. So although it shifts, you do not see that shift. Okay? It's very much like having a box of clocks with different clocks pointing to the different time. You look at it, you see all the times. Now you wait an hour, each clock moves. You still don't see the difference. It's very much like that. But that doesn't mean that it didn't move. Okay? So there is a change that also the capacitor feels. And it's a change at a distance. But in this particular example, nothing happens to the capacitor. Now, you may feel uneasy, and you want to see a change on the capacitor. You want to see a change on the capacitor, you should put a function of the capacitor that has the modular momentum not completely undefined. So, for example, let's put a capacitor in a superposition of being there and here. In this case, the capacitor will get entangled with the electrode at a distance. Okay? And so on and so forth. This is the beginning of part two.